Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's Upside Down Star Day. Greetings, my friends. When I was young, growing up in Lansing, Michigan, there was this local group. I believe they were called the Anabaptists, but I may be wrong. They were a fundamentalist offshoot of either the Baptists or the Methodists, who every year around this time would launch a crusade, a campaign to strip the satanic symbols out of our schools. Specifically, they didn't want us wearing witches' costumes and skeletons and all that kind of stuff. All that nasty Halloween stuff. They were convinced that this was, you know, the devil's working worse. And so one of the things that they were particularly upset about was that if you take a star, a five-pointed star, like you see on the American flag, the normal way that the five-pointed star is portrayed is with the head at the top, the point at the top, and the feet at the bottom, the two legs sticking out at the bottom, and the two arms sticking out at the sides. That's a normal five-pointed star. When you flip that upside down, then you have the two horns at the top of the goat, of the devil, right? You have the chin at the bottom, the single point down, and you have the two ear flaps sticking out to the side, the two sides. And so the star becomes the star, the satanic worshiper's star, at least according to those folks back then. And I find it fascinating, as a Halloween note, that the GOP in the last 5 years, 6 years, has chosen to flip the stars upside down on their logo. Take a look at the Republican logo, the giant elephant with the three upside down stars on it. Go figure. Anyhow, the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes worldwide. This from the Society for Physical and Atmospheric Sciences, a study published by Peter Webster, professor at Georgia Tech School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, and NCAR's Greg Holland. This whole study from of storms done from 1970 to 2004. The number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes worldwide has nearly doubled over the past 35 years, even though the total number of hurricanes has dropped since the 1990s, according to a study by researchers at the Georgia Institute of Technology and the National Center for Atmospheric Research. The shift occurred as global sea surface temperatures have increased over the same period. The research appeared in the September 16th issue of the journal Science. Said Webster, in the 1970s, there was an average of about 10 Category 4 and 5 hurricanes per year globally. Since 1990, the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes has almost doubled, averaging 18 per year globally. Curry, chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech and co-author of the science study, goes on to say, Category 4 and 5 storms are making up a larger share of the total number of hurricanes. They made up about 20% of all hurricanes in the 70s, but over the last decade, they account for 35% of these storms. Into this discussion comes the Competitive Enterprise Institute and Marlo Lewis with CEI, CEI.org, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And you can read their information over at CEI.org. Hey, Marlo, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Tom, thank you for having me.
You guys suggest that either what, this is not true, or the fact that the number of total hurricanes has declined slightly means that this has nothing to do with global warming. I read your thing here, and no provable link between Katrina and global warming. And yeah, I agree with that, but I'm not sure. How do you respond to that?
Well, the Webster study that you referred to is a very interesting study, and he, I think, did a very good job with the data that he had available. You'll note, though, that his data goes back to 1970.
Right.
And that's because there really isn't a lot of very good data in other hurricane basins outside of the Atlantic Hurricane Basin before 1970. So, you know, it's one possibility is that you know, there has been this increase since 1970, but that 1970 isn't a baseline that constitutes some kind of norm that goes back, you know, centuries or eons, but it might have been just the low point in a cycle. Now, Pat Michaels of the University of Virginia, who's also the Virginia State climatologist, did a study following up on Webster's of the Atlantic Basin, which, as I said, has the best data going back before 1970. And I believe that we included Pat's research in that paper. It's certainly in another paper that we have on our website called A Skeptic's Guide to an Inconvenient Truth. But what Pat found is that when you go back to 1950, you find that the number and percentage of Category 4, 3, 4, and 5, in other words, the big hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin, was as great or greater in the 1950s than it was in the 1990s.
But that's the key to that, though, is that you're including the Category 3 hurricanes, Marla.
Excuse me?
The key to that, though, is that you're including Category 3 hurricanes. If you the prediction
no, that's
of
what Webster was talking about.
If you take out the Category 3s, though, you don't see that.
No, look at the Category 4s and 5s in the same data, and you'll see that there is basically no change in the if you're comparing the 50s to the 90s, either in terms of the number of 4 and 5 hurricanes or the number or the percentage of 4 and 5 hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. We simply don't have enough data in other hurricane basins to do the same kind of comparison. And this is the problem with jumping to conclusions about, oh, this is global warming at work, because climate changes on various timescales, some of them, you know, annual, some of them decadal, some of them multi-decadal, some of them even longer. And so I think this is a very interesting result that Pat came up with when he looked at the hurricane data in the Atlantic Basin from 1940 to 2004. There's basically no change.
Again, including Category 3 hurricanes.
Of the major Category 4 and 5 hurricanes, but also no change in the Category 3s, which is something that Webster considered in his study.
Well, I looked at that, and I think you're misrepresenting it, because you can only pull that together if you include Category 3 hurricanes. If you only look at Category 4 and 5 hurricanes, the really severe ones, which are the ones that global warming would predict would increase, they actually do increase over the 1950s.
I'm looking at those charts right now, and basically
they include the Cat 3 ones.
Excuse me?
Those include the Cat 3 ones, the ones that you have on your website.
Yeah, but look at the lines that illustrate the Cat 4s and 5s. And you'll see there looks like there's...
Well, here's the larger question, right, Marlo. Let's assume that there is some periodicity to this. There are some cycles at work here that go beyond global warming. Here we have the British government coming out yesterday, Gordon Brown, the British Treasury chief, saying this could be a disaster, global warming. We're talking about something that's going to not just has the potential to screw up our lifetimes, but could wipe out our children and our grandchildren's lifetimes. Yesterday,
all right,
OPEC,
let's have a little healthy skepticism here. What did the British government also do just recently? They called for new taxes to fight global warming, new taxes on automobile use, new taxes on air transport.
That's right, because by using fossil fuels, what we are doing is allowing ourselves as consumers of fossil fuels, auto manufacturers as people who manufacture a product that uses fossil fuels, and certainly the fossil fuel industry, folks like the folks who fund you, ExxonMobil, who generate fossil fuels, that all of us collectively, we are internalizing the profits. That's we're taking the benefits over the short term, and we're externalizing the costs. We're throwing the costs off to future generations. And that just seems like a morally wrong thing to do.
Well, governments also love to internalize they love to internalize the profits of hardworking people.
Well, what they're talking about doing is capturing those costs.
And they need a good excuse to do it. Otherwise, they'll face a tax revolt. And I think it's just a little too convenient that their major study came out just at the time when they were calling for new taxes. And because they say the world will come to an end otherwise, but if we act in the current decade, if we act in the next 10 years, then the world won't come to an end. And that's just a little too convenient. That makes me very suspicious.
I didn't notice anywhere language about the world coming to an end. They were talking about, basically, if we don't spend 1% of GDP now, we're going to end up spending between 5 and 20% of GDP starting a decade or so from now, dealing with the costs of climate change.
Well, look, there are also other studies that challenge this idea that hurricanes are becoming much stronger or even measurably stronger as a result of global warming. There was a study by a guy named Klotzbach, Phil Klotzbach, which looked at hurricane activity in all of the hurricane basins around the world. And he basically found that there was an increase in the North Atlantic hurricane in the Atlantic hurricane basin, a decrease in hurricane strength in the Northeast Pacific.
But again, Marlo,
and basically no change anywhere else. So it looks, and actually, if you look at his data from 1990 to 2004, and you average it out over all the hurricane basins, hurricane strength goes down.
But Marlo Lewis, you have to acknowledge that the vast majority of scientists, the vast majority of climate scientists in the world, say there is no doubt global warming is happening. If even half of them said it's real, isn't there a moral issue here?
Yeah, but you know, I think it's also the case that, look, you can say that. You can say, oh, how dare we experiment with the only climate we have. But you can also say, well, what? It's not moral to run an uncontrolled experiment on the only economy we have. Okay. No one knows really how to fuel the world without fossil.
We're out of time. Marlo, well said. CEI.org, the website. Thank you for being with us. Back 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program. It's Halloween. It's that upside down Pentagon day, that upside down star, that GOP holiday when the monsters come out. Oh my. And the monsters are coming out. This whole larger issue of the Republicans, the oil companies trying to jigger science, trying to change this stuff all around, trying to basically reject even access to it. This Julie McDonald, for example, a civil engineer, she has no training in biology whatsoever. So what does the Bush administration do? What do the Republicans do in the White House? They make her the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. This is somebody with no biology experience at all, and she's in charge of this nation's biology. And according to this, the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Center for Biological Diversity just issued a report on this. And according to their report, she has rejected staff scientists' recommendations to protect imperiled animals and plants under the Endangered Species Act repeatedly. She presents industry positions as equivalent to scientific studies. In 2004, for example, this from the Center for American Progress, in 2004, a panel of Fish and Wildlife Service biologists recommended giving the greater sage grouse protection under the Endangered Species Act. This is, you know, a bird. But in her review of the panel's report, she denigrated many scientific studies as mere opinion and stated, we should treat them. We should treat the science studies, right? We should treat them as we would treat an industry publication. Now, when was the last time you heard of a peer-reviewed industry publication? She pressed staff biologists to more seriously consider industry positions. During a discussion of the great sage-grouse population, she wrote, this paragraph completely ignores the comments we received from the Owyhee Cattlemen's Association and the Idaho Cattle Association. Yeah. As the Washington Post points out, these cattlemen's associations who say, hey, ignore the possible extinction of this ground-living bird, are doing so because you've got to kill its habitat to provide grazing land for cattle. So what are you going to have? Species diversity? Or more cattle? Under McDonald, the Department of the Interior reversed a staff ruling based on comments from the Air Force. In 2000, FWS published a recognized a particular animal as a species, a Tabor Montana rotensis, as an endangered species. This is a tree, T. rotensis, that there are approximately 30 of these trees left, and there are 30 left on the earth. Remember the Pacific yew tree? This was like 20 years ago. The Pacific yew tree was nearly extinct. It was on the endangered species list. It was being protected. And as part of the science to try and figure out how to preserve and protect this tree, they discovered that there was a lot of folklore around it. The Native Americans in Southern California had for centuries, for millennia perhaps, used the Pacific yew tree to treat breast cancer. So, well, this is interesting. Let's check out and let's see if there's any, you know, potentially biologically active alkaloids or proteins in this plant. They checked it out, and they discovered that it has a compound that is today sold under the brand name Taxol, which is used as a treatment today for breast cancer. We never even would have known about that had that plant gone extinct. Now, that's, of course, the it's best for humans argument for not having extinctions. I mean, there are other arguments to be made as well, like life is an intricate web. It's a diverse thing. To say, oh, we can do without that, it's like saying, well, yeah, this cow is doing just fine. Let's remove its heart. It'll do just fine. We can take a piece of it out. We'll cut off one leg. We'll take, you know, take out its liver. It doesn't need it. All of the different species on Earth are part of an interrelated system. And when that system starts getting progressively more and more simple, it becomes progressively more and more fragile, easier to push over the edge, easier to destroy, putting not just the individual species at risk, but putting us at risk. So here's this plant. There's 30 of these plants left, and they're on land managed by the Air Force. And it was recognized as an endangered species. So in 2004, she reverses this, based on a comment from the Air Force. This is the Bush administration putting a civil engineer in charge of all the biology of the United States. Under the Bush administration, just 56 species have been listed under the Endangered Species Act, 10 a year. Under Clinton, it was about 64 a year. Under George Herbert Walker Bush, it was 59 a year. 27 minutes past the hour.
As a rider floated on by him, he heard one call his name. If you want to save your soul from hell riding on our range, then cowboy, change your ways. If they are with us, you will ride. Trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies. Yippee-i-oh.
And welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, look out for that devil riding after you, the devil with the upside-down star there. Just take a look at the GOP logo. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about. By the way, as we started out talking about global warming, it's interesting just to get these things on the table, because this is a huge issue in Europe right now. I mean, the British government saying 2 days ago, this is going to cost 5 to 20% of worldwide gross domestic product. For every nation on Earth, we're looking at 5 to 20% of GDP. The consequences of not doing something now, and we can do something now for about 1% of GDP. So it's time to invest to avoid disaster. Sort of like, you know, we can build, it's like Holland saying, you know, okay, we can build the dikes and prevent wiping the city out when the storm comes. Now, we didn't quite figure that out down in New Orleans, but the Dutch figured that out. So in the midst of this now, Tony Snow takes to the podium to address the issue.
The president has, in fact, contrary to stereotype, been actively engaged in trying to fight climate change and will continue to do so.
Yeah, George Bush, he's out there trying to fight climate change. Didn't you know? I mean, he's right out there at the forefront of the whole thing. Indeed. How's he doing it? Well, let's see. He's cutting some brush. Now, wait a minute. You cut the brush and you burn the brush and that puts carbon into the atmosphere. Maybe he's growing some brush someplace else. That must be it. He's got his old pig farm down there. Used to be just a pig farm, and now he's growing trees on it in a few places. And they're sequestering carbon. That must be it. Meanwhile, the Democrats are asking for details on Senator George Allen's arrest warrants. Yeah, a lot going on there. The GOP is looking into the assault of a waitress by a Republican running for Congress. Just a quick overview of a few of the bizarre things going on. Then we'll pick up a few of your calls here. The Interior Department, this is from thinkprogress.org, the Interior Department has dropped claims that oil giant Chevron systematically underpaid the government for natural gas produced in the Gulf of Mexico, a decision that could allow energy companies to avoid paying hundreds of millions of dollars in royalties. In other words, they're taking our gas from our commons and not paying us for it. And under the Clinton administration, they were saying, come on, guys, pay up. That gas belongs to we, the people of the United States of America. And the Bush administration is saying, you guys can have it for free. It's all right. It'll help your profits, right? Everything is going to be just fine. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Good show.
Thank you.
Well, I was listening to this, basically, the weather show from ExxonMobil. And I had to call in. I grew up in Iran. My dad worked for Mobil there. And, there's a sense of entitlement where we go around the world and pull resources out of countries and just decide that, they're ours. Or if we pay a corrupt government or even if we overthrow another government in order to get to it, that somehow or another we deserve that, So basically what these guys have done now is that they're offloading like you said, they're offloading the cost of, handling carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and whatever else, onto taxpayers. And I just thought it was so ironic when that guy said the British government likes to, internalize working people's income when the oil and gas industry just got $9.8 billion out of the taxpayer, in tax relief.
Yeah. I know.
And
these guys.
Not only that, but we're fighting a war right now in defense of their infrastructure, and we're spending 3,000 lives and $300 billion today to defend their profits.
Yeah, yes, and Bush saying to the Iraqi people when we first invaded, your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells. And Dick Cheney talking about oil, and this is very much the oil war.
It
really is. Good point, Jeff. Thank you very much. And the whole idea of externalizing costs, I mean, this is classic business. But these guys are, then they go to the argument, well, the British government wants to increase taxes on working people. The fact of the matter is that by and large, tax increases right across the board, no matter how you slice and dice them, tax increases are going to be felt by people who have control over their own income as opposed to people who don't. That's a really important point that everybody understood in the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, and everybody has forgotten since Reagan. That working people who work for a paycheck and are out there in the working marketplace, the marketplace of employees, that when taxes go up, wages go up, because people are paid, basically. People make all their calculations based on what their take-home pay is. And the marketplace will have to raise wages if taxes go up. But if you're making $100 million a year or $50 million a year or $1 million a year off investments, or because you own your own business and taxes go up, then you're not in a competitive marketplace. You're not out there in the general marketplace where of wages that are affected by taxes, and so that tax more directly affects you. So, folks like Rush Limbaugh, who's worth, over $100 million, folks like, the list goes on and on. These folks, when taxes go up, actually feel the consequences of it. They're paying a portion of their taxes, their money in taxes, whereas the average working person, taxes go up, so do salaries. I mean, it's just, it has to follow. Brad in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. And by the way, thanks for coming down to Eugene a couple weeks ago. It was great having you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm really pleased to be on the air on KOPT there.
Well, like yourself, I meet a lot of people, and even though the scientific community is overwhelming, my brother-in-law being one of them, it's amazing how many people are still out there that question what's happening with global warming. And when I meet people like that, I use this analogy. Say, Tom, you woke up this morning, and you felt a chest pain, and you thought, must have been something I ate last night. 2, 3, 4 days goes on it. If anything, it seems to be getting a little worse. So you go see the doctor, Tom. He says, you got to take one of these little pills every day, and you'll be okay. You go out and get 100 second opinions, and I'm talking Nobel Prize-winning doctors. And 99 of them, Tom, tell you, you have to take that little pill, and you'll be fine. And the one tells you, don't worry about it, Tom. It's just a little indigestion. Take some Pepto-Bismol, and you'll be fine. You cannot, I tell them this, you cannot look me straight in the eye and tell me that you're going to believe that one doctor over the 99 with your life on the line.
Yeah. And
it's people up and they go, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and our lives are on the line. Our children's lives are on the line. But tell that to Michael Palmer. He's the general manager of two local television stations in Maine. And he sent out an email recently to his employees saying that they were no longer allowed to cover climate change stories because they are, quote, in the same category as the killer African bee scare from the 1970s or more recently the Y2K scare when everyone's computer is going to self-destruct, end quote. I mean, this is how bizarre it gets. Brad, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Jennifer in Humboldt County. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Tom. One point about the caller earlier. Actually, investing in clean energies will increase our economy.
I know. It could be bigger than the dot-com boom.
And then I wanted to make another point that the biggest changes we do have to make probably involve federal legislation, like increasing the CAFE standards and putting a carbon cap on total carbon emissions in the United States, and that really is going to require this change in first in the House and the Senate, and then the White House. And I just wanted to give another plug for callforchange.org, which is MoveOn's program to call into close races. House races across the country to really get this change in the House so we can see some of this global warming legislation that's just sitting in these committees and can't get out because they're in complete control by the Republican
And
Congress.
This is what it all boils down to.
Yeah.
It all boils down to the rules of the game are set in Congress, and Congress right now is has sold out to the Republican Party has sold out to the big money interests, basically the oil companies here in this case, in this particular example.
Exactly.
And, you know, it ain't good. It's
and
just
people and actually I happen to be on a 7-day vacation from work so I can stay home and do these calls for Move On.
Good
on
you.
And then they're going to have these house parties this weekend, and you can do these calls from home. You can set up one of these house parties, and we know it's looking really good, but we can't take anything for granted.
Right. You too can be part of a massive nationwide phone bank to get out the vote, and moveon.org or callforchange.org are the two websites. Right, Jennifer?
That's it.
There you go.
Thanks,
okay.
Tom.
Good on you for doing it. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Yep, George Bush, as he's attacking Iraq.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And Dick Cheney.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change in America. Oh, there's that guy with the upside down stars again. Must be the Republicans come ass again. Welcome back. Happy Halloween. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservatives 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Right here, the EPA's principal library for researching the effects of properties and chemicals has been shut down. EPA's hasty buzzsaw slashing at its library network is now interfering with its mission of harnessing the best available science to protect human health and the environment. That from Jeff Roush, who is the Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Bush administration has already closed EPA and Washington headquarters library and regional posts in Chicago, Dallas, and Kansas City. I'm telling you, this is the kind of literally a threat to life on Earth brought to you courtesy of the Republican Party. These elections have very high stakes. Tamara in Joplin, Missouri. Hey, Tamara.
Well, good morning, Tom. It's me, Blue.
Hey, good morning, Blue.
I want to talk about something just a little off topic, but it's true. When has the Bush administration told us the truth about anything in the 6 years they've been in power?
Well, I suspect that, you know, when George W. claims that he hasn't had an affair with an intern, he's probably telling the truth, but...
Well, you never know.
Yeah, actually.
My question is, I've been keeping track of a website called tbrnews.org,
mm-hmm.
and Brian Herring claims that there's actually 15,000 dead American soldiers.
Right.
Not 3,000.
Right, I'm familiar with the claim.
And I want him to put up or shut up.
Yeah, well,
either he needs to tell the truth and expose the lies, or just take his website down because he's not.
The problem, Tamara, is that there are all kinds of websites all over the internet making all sorts of wild claims, and I agree with you. You know, put up or shut up, either documented or not, and it's not documented. The actual deaths are documented. We know who those soldiers are, and the families here in the United States will see their loved ones' names or not. On things like the McNeil-Lehrer report, I mean, you know, these guys every night list these names. They're in the newspapers. It's not like it's a secret. If there were 15,000 dead U.S. soldiers, I frankly don't think it would be possible to keep it, you know, covered up. So, in any case, Damien, thank you for the call, though. Damien in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, is it Damien or Darian?
Damien.
Hey, what's up?
These people who don't believe in global, warming, they're always asking for proof. And one day I was watching something on Discovery Earth Street Channel about Phoenix, Arizona, and they're saying how the environment has changed because of people, because, you know, you get your blacktop, the heat doesn't escape at night, so it stays, the whole, plus the water they brought in from, I believe they get it from the Colorado River, has changed the whole effect of the climate and that part of Phoenix, and there's proof right there.
Yeah, it's proof of the influence of human activity. It's not necessarily proof of, you know, the effect of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. For that, though, all you have to do is look at, you know, what's happening in the Arctic, look at the glaciers around the world, look at all around Alaska. Our listeners on KUDO and in Anchorage, from time to time calling in with stories about that. Yeah, some serious problems. Damien, thanks for the call. Tom in Bucksville, Alabama. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I want to thank you very much for what you do. I think that I don't know of any other program that strictly talks about the issues all the time, and I certainly appreciate that. One thing I wanted to bring up was, I don't know the exact amount of years that oil is left, that we have left in all the world's reserves. I read something yesterday, it was like 50 or 60 years at present consumption. But no one has ever brought up the fact that once that goes, airplanes won't fly and ships won't be able to cross the Atlantic or the Pacific or go anywhere in the world. So we basically have lost communications and thrown ourselves all the way back into the 1700s again.
Yeah, if the change were to happen that suddenly. The best estimates are that the planet had available or has available, accessible, around 2 trillion barrels of oil. And between 1856, when Colonel Drake drilled the first commercial oil well in the United States in Titusville, Pennsylvania, until today, we've pulled out a little over 1 trillion barrels. So that looks like a long period of time, 140 years more or less. But the reality is that, you know, we didn't use a whole lot of oil during most of that time compared to current rates. And the best guesses are that if there's another trillion barrels in the ground, and now there are some folks saying, no, it's actually 1.3 trillion, it's 1.4 trillion, or we're going to find, you know, deeper water oil that we didn't expect to find. It could be 1.5 trillion. That at current rates of consumption, we're looking at 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Some people are even saying 60 or 70 years, depending on what you expect to find. But the two problems with that are, number one, it's getting, a lot of this oil is getting much more expensive to extract. And number two, it doesn't include the cost of the carbon in the atmosphere. And this is what the British government is finally saying, and we need to be talking about in this country as well, is this externalized cost of global warming and the destruction that it is doing to the planet. And this is, if you don't think there's a political problem, I mean, this is at its core a political problem, one of many, obviously, and one that the Bush administration has been so far behind on. And in fact, you know, actively and aggressively working against. And yet you still have Tony Snow out there, you know, doing his, I mean, just incredible little snow
job. The president has, in fact, contrary to stereotype, been actively engaged in trying to fight climate change and will continue to do so.
Yeah, right, right. So that's, you know, that's the state of things. That's how much we have. That's where we're going with it. But the transition, hopefully, can be made in a rational fashion. If we simply let the free market make the transition for us, there's going to be a lot of people in the middle who are going to get wiped out. The transition will happen. Obviously, the cost of energy will go up. Alternatives will come along. They'll become more economical. They will explode, though. That transition will happen. The question is, are we going to make that transition in a way that minimizes the external damage to us and everybody else, every other living thing on this planet? Or are we going to make that transition in a more brutal and sudden way that puts us at risk and that destroys economies and that throws the entire world out of balance? And the Bush administration is clearly moving in the direction of the latter. The Carter administration was the last one to talk about the former, about let's do something about this now. And we really need to be having that conversation again. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy: the American by nature is optimistic. He's experimental, an inventor, and a builder who builds best when called upon to build greatly. Boy, man, sometimes you just long for a return to the days when this country was idealistic, optimistic, the light of the world. But instead we have the Republican Party and George W. Bush. Speaking to that, Wayne Madsen, WayneMadsenReport.com, M-A-D-S-E-N, Report.com, his website. He's the author of a new book, Jaded Tasks, Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil, The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company. Wayne, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
Great to have you on. Your book details how America's economic and intelligence associations with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan led directly to 9/11 and the role that private military companies are playing in George W. Bush's New World Order. Let's take those as two separate things. First of all, how did our relationship with Saudi Arabia? I know that the morning of 9/11, Bush Sr. was having breakfast with the brother of Osama bin Laden, as the towers were being hit. How did our relationship with Saudi Arabia lead to 9/11?
Well, it was really accentuated with the Saudi connection to the Bush family, because you look at this history and you find that the Saudis were anteing up money for old George W. back in Texas when he was trying to get his business off the ground. It was
this is Salman bin Laden bailed out Harkin Oil, didn't he?
That's right, yeah, and they bailed out Harkin, and then we've got Jeb running over to the Persian Gulf and to the Saudi Arabia after the first Gulf War, and we've got Neil Bush over getting contracts for his software education company, Ignite, making deals with the Saudis and the Emirates, and of course, there were three countries that recognized the Taliban. Taliban when they were giving safe harbor to bin Laden. It was Saudi Arabia, our good friends, the United Arab Emirates, our other good friends, and Pakistan, all now being, that were being told by the Bush administration, gosh, these countries are really good partners in the war against terrorism. Well, if that's the case, they were aiding the and recognized the Taliban, aiding the Taliban at the same time Al-Qaeda was there. And also, the other thing was many people in this administration were involved in early negotiations with the Taliban government over building the Central Asian Gas Pipeline through Afghanistan to Pakistan and the Indian Ocean coast. And
wasn't Hamid Karzai, the current president of Afghanistan at that time, a consultant for one of the American oil companies and participating in that?
That's right. Hamid Karzai was a consultant for UNICAL. And Zalmay Khalilzad, who was in Afghanistan as their ambassador, now is in Iraq, was also a consultant on that deal.
Hmm. Yeah, we will offer you a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs was the famous saying that came out of that. Wayne Madsen, I'm curious your take on this notion that the war on terror is as much a rhetorical device as the war on drugs or the war on illiteracy, and that really what we have here is, frankly, a very small-scale blowback to some of our foreign policy, where the small-scale blowback, 19 guys with box cutters, happened to hit a pretty visible target. But it's really nothing that should be considered even close to a war, that Osama bin Laden had maybe 5,000 followers at his peak, and that by and large we've managed to inflame the Muslim world, you know, and Bush is making things worse with every single day that goes by, but that as of 9/11 there was really no quote terror to have a quote war on. There was just a small band of crackpot zealots within the Muslim world.
Well, that's right. I remember a quote from Gore Vidal, who said, "Fighting a war against terror is like fighting a war against dandruff." I mean, yeah. Yes, terrorism has always been a problem. But if we look back at what we did with the Mujahideen and their war against the Soviet Union, we were the ones who went in there and radicalized these elements against the great Soviet menace. And of course, it came back to bite us in a very big way. And we see, Al-Qaeda being nurtured by the Pakistani intelligence service. Another guy who was in Washington on the morning of 9/11, of course, was General Mahmoud Ahmed, who was the head of the Inner Services Intelligence Agency of Pakistan, and
ISI.
He was having meetings with people like Richard Armitage.
And ISI, as the Pakistani intelligence service, had wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta just, 2 weeks before that?
Wired $100,000 to Florida, to a bank in Florida. And Florida seems to be such a nexus for this whole pre-9/11, because after all, we remember George W. Bush sitting in the Emma Booker School, with the 7-minute staring into the headlights look on his face.
And
we had Atta getting flight training in his merry band of insurgents down in Florida.
Yeah, and of course, Jeb Bush running the state.
And Jeb Bush.
That's
always convenient.
Yeah, it's so incredibly convenient. So, okay, so that first part of this, it's interesting, blowing apart some of these myths. You say that you talk about the role that private military companies are playing in George W. Bush's New World Order. Are we seeing now the realization of the absolute takeover of the United States government by the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about in 1960 as he left office? 61.
Oh my God, yes, we're seeing that. We're hearing stories now coming out. Hopefully, one of the first things that the Democratic Congress would do would be to investigate all the waste with the Coalition Provisional Authority of Jerry Bremer in Iraq. We know that stacks of money were bound together with saran wrap and being thrown around and kicked around. There's $9 billion missing from that. And, of course, a lot of this money, as we know with the scandal with Duke Cunningham and these other scandals with the Republicans on the Hill, involved these private military contractors who were like just a bunch of parasites waiting to jump in there and start feeding off the taxpayers' money when we got into Iraq, and also they were involved in Afghanistan, and now they're involved in places all around the world where the United States is sticking its nose, from Haiti to Colombia to Southeast Asia and all these other so-called hot spots for terror. We find these private military contractors. We used to call them mercenaries, but of course that's not, that term isn't in favor anymore because we are using the mercenaries and not the colonial powers of Europe.
So what do we do about this, Wayne Madsen?
Well, I'm kind of encouraged. I'm now stepping out of the Beltway for a while, and here in the Pacific Northwest, I get a sense that finally people are looking at this situation, saying we need a massive change, and hopefully next week we'll bring that. I'm just hoping, and I do get this sense from talking to people, because you get kind of, to use the title of my book, Jaded Tasks, you get jaded being in the Beltway, and I'm somewhat encouraged by what I'm hearing and the people I'm talking to, that there is a change pending here, and hopefully we'll start getting some real oversight hearings, start subpoenaing some of these Bush administration officials, and of course that's a mighty powerful tool for Congress to have that power.
So you're not cynical that the Democratic Party is as much in the pocket of the military-industrial complex as the Republican Party?
Oh, there's certainly a lot of Democrats who are, and I know some in Congress right now who've taken as much money from these interests as some of the Republicans. But I'm also encouraged by some of the Democratic candidates who beat the establishment candidates in the primaries and are really a breath of fresh air. And I think when they get to Washington, I think they'll be demanding that it's not business as usual. And I'm somewhat encouraged. Of course, my caveat is the voting machines, and hopefully we can keep the fraud to a minimum. But again, that's a big caveat.
Not just the voting machines, also the private corporations that are on computers maintaining the voting rolls.
And the tabulators and all the other. And, of course, Karl Rove's talking about this 72-hour blitz, which, I would I'm just very concerned about what he's talking about there, because we've seen the voter intimidation before at the polls.
Yeah, we definitely have. We're talking with Wayne Madsen. His website, WayneMadsenReport.com. He's the author of a new book, Jaded Tasks, Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil, The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company. Why brass plates? You're talking about phony companies, offshore companies?
That's right, what they call these folding tin operations. We saw that, of course, with the Enron scandal. Many of these offshore entities in the Cayman Islands and Liechtenstein and the Isle of Man, they only exist to hide the money they're laundering.
Well, this is what Halliburton has done with KBR, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, and Halliburton's one of them. Of course, we saw all these, every time there's a Republican scandal, we see a lot of these brass plates come out. We saw it with the Iran-Contra scandal. Of course, Ollie North, of course, used the Cayman Islands to hide the money transfers between Iran and Central America. So.
Back during the Iran-Contra scandal. Wayne Madsen, WayneMadsenReport.com is website. You're doing a book tour now, San Francisco, Eugene, Portland, whatnot. I'm assuming it's all on your website?
Yes, it is. I'll be in Portland tomorrow night at the Unitarian Church.
Great. Okay. WayneMadsenReport.com, the website. Jaded Tasks, Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil, The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company. 16 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Wayne. And welcome back. Yeah, it's that upside-down five-pointed star day. The upside-down five-pointed star that the Satan worshippers all use. Just take a look at the GOP logo. Quite different from the American flag. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Wolf Blitzer, blindsided by Lynn Cheney. Dick Cheney now gloating about it. This is over at Fox News. This is... tragic. I have to say, this is just, here we go.
Your wife, Mr. Vice President, created a little bit of a stern appearance on a rival news network last week, taking exception to the way that network portrayed the economy, the government, that things are going to hell in a handbasket. I'm sort of paraphrasing here. Actually, she was much more to the point than I'm being. What did you think of that?
I thought it was great. We refer to it around the house as the slap down. And she was very tough, but she was very accurate and very aggressive.
Yeah, the slapdown. Well, you know, first of all, Blitzer seeming like he's in shock about this. We'll get to that in just a minute. But first, let's just, check out this so-called slapdown.
You know, I understand your point. It's kind of the point of a lot of people right now to try to distort the administration's position. And if you really want to talk about that, I watched the program on.
See, this is, you guys are trying to distort the administration's position. Don't you get it? You're the media, and anything you say about us isn't fawning like over at Fox is a distortion.
CNN last night, which I thought it's your 2006 voter program, which I thought was a terrible distortion of both the president and the vice president's position on many issues.
How about one? How about just one? No, she's not going to go there.
It seemed almost straight out of Democratic talking points, using phrases like domestic surveillance.
You guys do domestic surveillance.
You know, I think that you might be a little careful before you declare this as a person with clean hands.
You're referring to the CNN Broken Government special. This was the one that John King reported
on last night. Right there, Wolf.
See, and here Wolf is going to try and defend John King. He's a real journalist. He actually graduated from journalism school.
Broken government. What kind of stance is that? Here we are. We're a country where we have been mightily challenged over the past 6 years. We've been through Katrina. And the vice president inherited a recession. We're a country where the economy is healthy. This government has acted very well. I'm going to talk about my book, but if you want to talk about distortion.
We'll talk about your book.
Right, but what is CNN doing? Running tape of terrorists shooting Americans. I mean, I thought Duncan Hunter asked you a very good question, and you didn't answer it. Do you want us to win?
At this point, now, CNN had run this tape, which they labeled on the screen terrorist propaganda, and it was a terrorist propaganda tape, and they're saying, hey, this is the kind of stuff that the rest of the world has seen. And Blitzer is just shocked. She's saying, here is Lynn Cheney saying, do you want the terrorists to win or America? And Blitzer is like, what?
The answer is we want the United States. We are Americans. There's not about terrorists to win, but there's
terrorist
all due respect. This is not terrorist propaganda. This is reporting the news.
Yeah, this is not terrorist propaganda. This is reporting the news. Well, yeah, she slapped him down just righteously. And then later, Wolf Blitzer spoke to America and said he had, had some problems with his patriotism being impugned.
Friday in the Situation Room here on CNN, I interviewed the wife of the vice president, Lynn Cheney. Mrs. Cheney has been a frequent guest on my programs. In this most recent interview, she of course knew we would be speaking about politics. That was reaffirmed to her staff only hours before the interview.
In other words, I thought you just wanted to talk about my children's book. No. We knew what this was going to be about. And she came in with her attack lines all ready to go.
As a former co-host of CNN's Crossfire program during the 1990s, she knows her way around the media. She was never shy in sparring with Democratic strategist Bob Beckel, her co-host. Still, I was frankly surprised when she came out swinging on Friday, surprised by what she said about CNN's Broken Government series, specifically the excellent one-hour report by our chief national correspondent, John King, one of the most precise and respected journalists in Washington. At CNN, his decision to air sniper video provided to our intrepid Baghdad correspondent Michael Ware by insurgents in Iraq, which Anderson Cooper specifically branded, and I'm quoting now, a single propaganda tape. Surprised at her sniping at my patriotism.
Yeah, well, Wolf, I would say you're surprised. You're surprised? I mean, this is what they're all about. Anybody, if you're not with us, you're against us. If you're not with us, you're a terrorist. I mean, this is their game plan, is to try to equate this administration with the government. Like you're either, well, as Bush said,
either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
And Wolf, you're evil, right? I mean, it's got to be. Because you're not obviously with us. So therefore, if you're just trying to be neutral, you must be against us. You must be evil. I mean, keep in mind, after the 2001 appointment of George W. Bush to the presidency by the Supreme Court, one of the senior vice presidents of CNN made a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. to apologize. Yes, this was reported in the Associated Press. To apologize for the coverage of George W. Bush up to that point and to assure the White House that Bush would be portrayed in a favorable way in the future by CNN. And these guys have been sucking up to the Bush administration for five and a half years. And gee, they get surprised when, after this rattlesnake that they've been playing with that they thought was so nice turns around and bites them. Wake up, guys. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change in America. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 days from now, an election happening. Actually, it's happening right now. In fact, this is really interesting. We have Republicans and Democrats and conspiracy theories on both sides about all this. The Wall Street Journal reporting today. Republicans, this John McKinnon and Erica Lovely. The headline, Republicans see edge from early voting. So it's like the Republicans are out there saying, hey, you know, the early vote looks like we're going to win. And then there are some folks saying, oh, this is the Republicans getting out their early vote so that they can claim when they steal the election a little later on, in the, you know, when the vast majority of the votes are cast on election day, when they steal that election, they can say, hey, you know, the early vote showed that we were winning, so why would you think that we wouldn't win in the main one? So is it that, or is it that there is no Republican edge in the early voting? They're just saying it, again, for the same reason, or maybe they're just saying it to activate their base. Who knows? The subhead of today's article in the Wall Street Journal, Democrats question specific claims and believe they are catching up with the trend. Down in the polls and with their majorities in Congress at risk, write McKinnon and Lovely in the Wall Street Journal, Republicans say they have some good news in early voting statistics that suggest their voter turnout machine is providing an edge in some tight races. And I'm sure by referring to it as a machine, there was no pun intended. They say if the trend holds, it could mean that early voting is growing and continuing to benefit Republicans who exploited the practice in the 1990s. This year, though, they add, Democrats contend that Republicans are exaggerating their successes so far by highlighting a few races while ignoring problems they're having and motivating the troops around the country. Democrats also question several specific Republican claims while noting that their own early voting numbers show they are starting to catch up with their rivals in early get-out-the-vote efforts in battleground states such as Iowa. For example, in New Mexico, the fiercely contested New Mexico district held by Republican Heather Wilson, the party says that the number of absentee ballots already requested by Republicans has almost reached the number requested in 2004, nearly 22,000 so far this year, compared with almost 24,000 in 2004. So the Republican Party says, hey, this is good news for them. But maybe not. Maybe not, because Heather Wilson is in big trouble in New Mexico. Could be that the Democrats are asking. I mean, I'm not reading from the Wall Street Journal. It could be the exact opposite. Meanwhile, in the bellwether Ohio district held by Republican Steve Chabot, about 60% of all early votes are coming from the roughly 40% of the electorate that the party has targeted for early voting, highest rate in the country. So the Republicans are aggressively trying to get out these early voters. Why? Maybe so that as news continues to trickle out about disasters that involve the Republican Party, Republicans won't go down in flames because they will have already voted. In two Florida districts that are in doubt, the 13th and 16th, previously held by Representatives Catherine Harris and Mark Foley, respectively, Republicans are ahead in both absentee voting and early voting. In previous election cycles, Democrats have enjoyed an advantage in early voting, party operatives say. Democrats, however, questioned the Republicans' claims, particularly regarding New Mexico's first district. They said Democrats are almost even with Republicans in the number of absentee ballots cast so far in the area. It's a bunch of spin, says Stacey Paxton, Democratic National Committee spokeswoman. Is it spin or is it a setup? Taking this, you know, just putting this in context, yesterday, Chris Matthews aired the debate for governor of, I believe it was Maryland. Might have been Virginia. I don't remember the state. In any case, it was a gubernatorial race. And they had, you know, a generic Democrat and a generic Republican, basically, on there. And an independent. A guy who was with the old Ross Perot party, the Reform Party. And, you know, these guys were basically, you know, just doing their platitudes. And at one point, Chris Matthews turns to the Democrat and he says, you know, you've voted with Nancy Pelosi most of the time and you're in, you know, you're in favor of this, that and the other thing. Doesn't that mean you're a liberal? And this guy looked like somebody had just, you know, pick your lousy cliche, you know, kicked him in the groin or stuck him with a cattle prod or whatever. I mean, he just... And then he goes into this thing about, well, I take this position and that position and this. And Matthews lets him spin the whole thing out. And when he's all done, Matthews says, so you're saying you're a liberal? And he says, no, you can't pigeonhole me that easily. George Washington called himself a liberal. I don't know what, you know, what these guys, somebody needs to find this piece of this clip from Jack Kennedy in 1960, speaking before the Liberal Party in New York State about why he's a liberal. And have these guys memorize this. I mean, this is just so straightforward.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
Then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal. I mean, how long has it been? I'm proud to say I'm a liberal. And then Kennedy goes on to define the traditional liberal ideals of America.
But first, I would like to say what I understand the word liberal to mean and explain in the process why I consider myself to be a liberal and what it means in the presidential election of 1960. In short, having set forth my views, I hope for all time 2 nights ago in Houston, on the proper relationship between church and state, I want to take this opportunity to set forth my views on the proper relationship between the state and the citizen. This is my political credo.
And now,
I believe in human dignity as the source of national purpose.
And now he's laying this out, right? The human dignity. This is the what liberals believe in.
In human liberty as the source of national action. And the human heart as the source of national compassion. And in the human mind as the source of our invention and our ideas. It is, I believe, this faith in our fellow citizens, as individuals and as people, that lies at the heart of the liberal faith.
See, and Kennedy has so nailed this thing at this point, because if you go back and you look at the historic debate between conservatives and liberals, what you find, and I'm talking all the way back to this, to the 1600s and the 1700s, the 17th and 18th centuries. What you find is that the classic conservatives like Malthus and Hobbes and Sir Edmund Burke fundamentally believed that human nature is evil and that government has to have great power and be a restraining force, or religion has to have great power and be a restraining force to restrain the evil impulses of humans. Otherwise, as Hobbes pointed out in Leviathan, without the iron grip of a powerful government or church, that human nature would cause our society to revert back to its primitive state, and life would once again become nasty, brutish, and short. Whereas the liberals of the Enlightenment, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, James Madison, they believed that humanity was fundamentally good. And yes, there are some evil people among us. We want to isolate them from us, you know, put them in prison, or try to rehabilitate them. There are some people who are truly... But the fundamental nature of humans is to be good. And therefore, the purpose of society is to advance life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not to restrain evil and go after evildoers. You get it? Once you understand this is the fundamental cleavage between the worldview of conservatives and liberals, then you get the difference between the way that George Bush views the world and how Americans have historically viewed the world. Kennedy continues.
For liberalism is not so much a party creed or a set of fixed platform promises as it is an attitude of mind and heart, a faith in man's ability through the experiences of his reason and judgment to increase for himself and his fellow men the amount of justice and freedom and brotherhood which all human life deserves.
You see, there it is. I mean, just laying it right out. And he, you know, he continues, in fact, with us, and I'll share a little bit more of it on the other side of the break here, because this, we need to reach out to Democrats in the United States and say, hey, liberal is okay. Liberal is what this country is founded on. Our founders were liberals. Liberal is the ideal. Forget about what Rush Limbaugh has said. Forget about the conservatives running around brandishing this word like it's a weapon. We can take it back. 45 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. It's Halloween. Yeah, I know the Medal of Freedom is an upside-down star. It's because it hangs appropriately that way. But it's the only upside-down star in American iconography. Everywhere else on our flag and every place else, the star is right side up, with the head up at the top, the feet down, the arms out. Today is Halloween. It's GOP Day. It's the day that some folks are concerned is the devil-worshipping day. Oh, my goodness. And they, you know, that goat, that upside-down five-pointed star with the two horns up at the top and the ear flap sticking out to the side and the chin whiskers sticking down. You can see three of them on the Republican elephant, the official GOP logo. Just compare the mindset of this guy.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, danger, doom killers. Be afraid, the world will drift toward tragedy.
Now, this is all from Bush's speech before the Republican National Convention, talking to his own people. This is George W. Bush.
We have fought the terrorists across the earth. Evil. We are staying on the offensive, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back, and we will prevail.
And you're getting a certain sense of what the conservative mind view, worldview is all about. It's all about being afraid and being aggressive in the face of that fear.
As it planned attacks. Free Afghanistan, terror, Pakistan, terrorists, Saudi Arabia, Libya, weapons.
Okay,
programs.
So you get enough of that already. Okay, thank you very much, George. Now, the traditional liberal ideals of America.
I believe also in the United States of America, in the promise that it contains and has contained throughout our history, of producing a society so abundant and creative and so free and responsible that it can not only fulfill the aspirations of its citizens, but serve equally well as a beacon for all mankind. I do not believe in a super state. I see no magic to tax dollars, which are sent to Washington and then returned. I abhor the waste and incompetence of large-scale federal bureaucracies in this administration, as well as in others. I do not favor state compulsion when voluntary individual effort can do the job and do it well. But I believe in a government which acts, which exercises its full powers and its full responsibilities. Government is an art and a precious obligation.
And a precious obligation. So he's, you know, saying basically we're all in favor of being responsible. That's liberal. And this is all the same speech, by the way. This is contiguous. It's about being responsible, and it's also about being proactive in a positive way, because we have this positive worldview and this belief in the potential for humanity and human beings.
And when it has a job to do, I believe it should do it. And this requires not only great aims, but that we propose concrete means of achieving them.
And this is where we come back to our ideals, to our vision as a liberal nation.
Our responsibility is not discharged by an announcement of virtuous ends. Our responsibility is to achieve these objectives with social invention, with political skill, and executive vigor. I believe for these reasons that liberalism is our best and our only hope in the world today.
Liberalism is our best and only hope in the world today. Where is a politician who will say this?
A liberal society is a free society. And it is, at the same time, and for that reason, a strong society. Its strength is drawn from the will of free people committed to great ends and peacefully striving to meet them. Only liberalism, in short, can repair our national power, restore our national purpose, and liberate our national energies. And the only basic issue in the 1960 presidential campaign is whether our government will fall in a conservative rut and die there, or whether we will move ahead in the liberal spirit of daring, of breaking new ground, of doing in our generation what Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and Adlai Stevenson did in their time of influence and responsibility.
There you go. John Kennedy speaking about why he is proud to be a liberal and what it means to be a liberal, the historic perspective of America. This is just the key to the whole thing. It really is. Ed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed, thanks for listening to WPTT. What's up?
Hey, Tom, fantastic show. I just enjoy listening to you, whether I'm on Sirius or at home here on the web.
What's up?
I found the text to that speech, and I just posted it to the discussion community in the U.S. domestic politics.
Yeah, it's a brilliant speech. You know, it's just brilliant.
And have you read the book by Carville and Begala, Take It Back?
I have not read every word of it. I have it.
You know what? I love that book. And why it parallels what you're talking about is throughout the book, Begala just does a wonderful job of showing how we can take back the issues that the Republicans have stolen from us as Democrats. And second, he weaves Christianity, religion, throughout the book in each of the themes, so that you can take back the issue of religion that we used to have back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that, first of all, this country was not founded as a religious nation, but it was founded on the same values that Christianity is founded on.
Exactly.
You know, if there is somebody hungry among us, we have an obligation to make sure that that doesn't continue. If there's somebody homeless among us, we have an obligation to make sure that that doesn't continue. I mean, the first budgets of the United States provided for literally for the welfare of the people. In fact,
you know, I don't understand why we don't, as Democrats and the politicians, don't stand up and say, look, these are our values because they're Christian values.
And Jewish values and Hindu values and Buddhist values and Muslim values. And they're the fundamental human values. This is the fundamental values of humanity. And what the conservatives say is, no, the values that we're going to run on are fear and distrust. Look out, those gays are going to come and get you. Look out in Tennessee, Harold Ford, you know, he's a black guy. That's all the Republicans have to offer. That's all conservatives historically have had to offer, is fear. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Back. It's Halloween, and sometimes, you know, everything you know about Halloween and some of the associated things are what you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you need to know, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you're not even sure that what you know is what you know. I mean, you know, sometimes.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Possibly. Elizabeth Kostova is with us. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling novel, The Historian. Elizabeth, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you very much.
It's your book. The focus of your book is Dracula, if I have this right.
That's right.
And you did a significant amount of research on that topic for the book. Tell us who was Dracula?
Well, you know, it's fascinating, Tom. Dracula really was two different people, and I got more and more interested in this as I did work on my book and did a lot of research for it. Dracula was, of course, the vampire we all know and love from Bram Stoker's 1897 novel, Dracula. Mm-hmm. And that's a novel, by the way, that has never been out of print since it was published more than 100 years ago.
Wow.
It's a great read. And, of course, it's given rise to all those beloved Hollywood movies, all those classic movies. And that author, Bram Stoker, used a real name from history. And that name was, again, Dracula. And that was an honorary title given to a nobleman, a prince, in the late 1400s in part of what is now Romania, who was a real person and both a very feared and respected...
Yeah, this was Vlad the Impaler, wasn't it?
That's right. That was his name.
And so, Count Vladimir what?
Well, his name was Vlad, which is a Romanian name, and he was officially known as Vlad the Third of Wallachia, this region that he governed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. And why was he referred to as Vlad the Impaler?
Well, he was a very harsh and brutal tyrant. He was used a lot of pretty dreadful torture on political enemies, and sometimes on his own people. He had a pretty awful track record.
So he was basically, he was what you get if you have a mass murderer who happens to be born into royalty.
Yes, or, you know, I think some historians would argue that he was actually a sadist, you know, that this was an illness.
Yeah, that's what I mean. If one of these guys that we lock up in prison after they've killed a half a dozen people, he actually owned the prisons.
Well, that's a good way to put it, yes.
Yeah. So how did Vlad the Impaler, just basically this you know, evil, psycho, actual 14th century member of the Romanian nobility, become Bram Stoker's a drinker of blood who can't see the daylight, and become a character in your novel, the historian, Elizabeth Kostova?
Well, Bram Stoker set out to write a vampire novel. He knew he wanted to write a vampire novel, which was already... a tradition. There were a lot of vampire novels in the 19th century, but he wanted to write a new and different and special one, and he wanted to have a noble name from history, from real history, to attach to his vampire. And he actually never went to Romania. It's very interesting. He did his research at home in the British Museum Library in London, and he came across this name from history. And you can imagine how exotic that would have been for English people in the late 19th century. So he used that name for his supernatural creature.
So you actually went to Romania.
I've spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe. That's right. And actually, the book, which covers a lot of different countries, my book, The Historian, is all about places I've either lived in or traveled to over the years.
Mm-hmm. And formed into a novel here, and is your what is the nature of your Dracula?
Well, you know, I have to say he's kind of a blend of those two different Draculas. It's a partly supernatural novel, but it's also very much about real history, and about three generations of historians who find themselves on the trail of this real historical figure, Vlad the Impaler.
That sounds fascinating. Well, thank you, Elizabeth Kostova, the author of The Historian. It's available in bookstores. Debuted number one on the New York Times bestseller list for fiction. I'm sure the book is available everywhere, right?
Yes, it's just out in paperback, and I'm also on tour reading from it this month.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Good speaking with you, Elizabeth.
You too. Bye-bye.
Fascinating stuff. You know, I don't know why I find it. I do know why. I think we're all fascinated by the dark side of life, right? We're all, you know, it's like watching George W. Bush. It's like, you know, the slow motion disintegration of, tragically, of the United States now we're seeing. But
It's fascinating. People slow down for car accidents and fistfights. Lynn in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Lynn, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. What's on your mind today?
Tom, you were posing the question of where's the Democrat that will stand up and say he's a liberal?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to submit Dennis Kucinich.
In the
Democratic debates, one of the questioners asked if they were liberal, and they all kind of tried to back off. But Dennis proudly said, yes, I'm a liberal.
Yeah, and he is, and many others are, and it's just such a shame that that word has been demonized. I mean, this is part of the con strategy. It's really a destructive political strategy to take every person's strength and destroy it. John Kerry's being a vet. Take that strength and destroy it.
Yeah.
The liberal traditions of this country and destroy them. I mean, the concept of the separation of church and state on which this country was founded, destroy it. The idea of freedom of the press, destroy it. The Fourth Amendment, the right of privacy, the concept that we should be secure in our homes and papers and effects against government intrusion unless there's sworn testimony and evidence that we've committed a crime. Destroy it. The freedom of speech. Let's set up free speech zones and isolate people. Destroy it. And right on down the line, they are destroying the strongest points of America, and they're destroying people who dare to speak up against them. And they're destroying the only few phrases that have historically defined America, like the word liberal. And it's a crime against America. It is an absolute utter crime against America. I don't know how else to say it.
The politics of destruction.
That's exactly what it is. Lynn, thank you very much for the call. It's Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, Roy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. I just thought I'd let your listeners know what's going on here in Albuquerque, and I imagine it's going on around the country. Our local right-wing hate radio, 50,000-watt big boomer rush outlet, is talking about early voting in the worst negative circumstances. It's almost like they're trying to keep people away.
Wait a minute. They're talking by and large to Republicans, and read of this stuff is that the Republicans are trying to get their own base out to vote early. Sounds like you're contradicting that.
Well, I agree with that, but it's like the people that don't know what's going on. And it really surprised me. And all I can think of is that it's that middle ground, those folks that might be just listening that I don't know.
Yeah.
But I was so confused as far as in early voting, getting that down. It's almost like they want to drive the machine, but we got tabulators now.
Yeah.
You know, we're paper ballot. Everything is 100% paper ballot.
Right.
And I was just totally confused. Because as you said, they want their folks out. But it's like, I don't know. I guess if you've got the faithful and the dedicated, they're going to do it. But the folks that are just kind of tuning in and don't really know what's going on, that can't, you know, that might tend to go Democrat, turning them on. I'm being so unclear, but it is just so confusing.
It's fascinating. It's more
like they're setting it up so that if they get beat, and then they go to court, or, you know, then they can lock it up and go to court and all this other stuff.
Right. Well, this brings us
of the aspects that I haven't heard much about is, you know, there's been some discussion about when they lose, they'll go to court.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it is. I just thought I'd throw it out because
it's interesting, right?
Information.
Indeed, and it brings up one of the more interesting conspiracy theories, which is that there won't be an October surprise, there will be a November surprise, that the day after the elections or 2 days after the elections, when questions start being raised about Republican victories or about Democratic victories, for that matter, that Republicans intend to challenge by questionable means, that some bomb will get dropped. I don't mean literally, although it could be metaphorical. It could be, you know, some major crisis with North Korea, major crisis with Iran. Something will happen that will divert the news cycle away from the charges that the election was rigged or vice versa, the Democratic victories. 16 minutes past the hour.
Now listen, I watched the news last night on TV. Another scandal up there in D.C., Jack Abramoff, Duke Cunningham, Tom DeLay.
Well, there's a new one most every other day. And you got Halliburton camped out in the lobby, making handshake deals behind closed doors. You better do something fast about the price of gas, cause I've been paying for mine and for yours. So I'm taking my country back.
This is the week, my friends. This is the week. Get over to MoveOn.org or the various, I mean, the state parties. Show up, volunteer, make phone calls, go door to door, toss another $25 at a candidate. There are so many things that can be done right now to take our country back. And the time is so short. 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff today raised the national threat level to red after intelligence reports indicated that a national election could be imminent. This according to Andy Borowitz. Speaking at a Washington press conference, Mr. Chertoff said that his department made the difficult decision to ratchet the nation's terror alert system up to the highest level after being assured by intelligence officials that the threat of an impending election was, quote, credible. Mr. Chertoff said, we do not know exactly when the election will take place, but we have credible information suggesting it will happen on or around November 7th. The Homeland Security Secretary said that intelligence sources believe that the Al-Qaeda terror network might be implementing a plan to booby-trap voting machines, causing the machines to explode if a voter pulls a lever or pushes a button for a Democratic candidate. My advice to all voters who are thinking of voting for Democrats, Mr. Chertoff said, is to stay at home until this current threat passes. In this business, it's better to be safe than sorry. The warning from the Department of Homeland Security drew a harsh rebuke from Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean, who said that the timing of the Homeland Security Department's move doesn't pass the smell test. But Mr. Chertoff remained unfazed by Mr. Dean's criticism, arguing, who are the American people going to believe? Someone who's politically motivated? Or the Department of Homeland Security? Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for lighting up the day a little bit. In a stealth manner, George W. Bush has signed into law a provision which, according to Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, will actually encourage the president to declare federal martial law. Now, what kind of confluence are we seeing here? Pat Leahy comes out and speaks out against this, the senator from Vermont. This is part of the $500 billion authorization for the Pentagon, which basically everybody wants to vote yes on, because nobody wants to say, have it be said that, oh, you're not supporting the Pentagon, quack, quack, quack. The John Warner Defense Authorization Act of 2007, H.R. 5122. And in it is this little piece that basically eviscerates posse comitatus, that does away with the notion that this law, which was passed back in 1878, as I recall, during Reconstruction, 1878, the Posse Comitatus Act, which simply reads, whoever, except in cases and under circumstances expressly authorized by the Constitution or Act of Congress, willfully uses any part of the Army or Air Force as a posse comitatus or otherwise to execute the laws, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. In other words, according to the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, if the president tries to use the military inside the United States against American citizens, he can go to jail for 2 years. And this new defense appropriations bill that George W. Bush just signed, that has gone to Bush, Pat Leahy coming out and saying, hey, wait a minute. We have modified the Posse Comitatus Act, 18 U.S.C. 1385. We've modified the Insurrection Act, 10 U.S.C. 331, both of which prohibit the military from involving itself inside the United States. You see these pictures of third world countries where the military is coming out against the people. And you say, well, that could never happen in the United States, because back in 1878 during Reconstruction, they, to say the Civil War is over. We're not going to have a war. We're not going to have American soldiers shooting at Americans ever again. Because this law was passed. But the Republicans have built into this Defense Authorization Act of 2007 a couple of paragraphs that basically blow away the Posse Comitatus Act and the Insurrection Act. And the only person who spoke out is Pat Leahy. He says, the 2007 Defense Appropriation Act contains a widely opposed provision to allow the president more control over the National Guard, adopting changes to the Insurrection Act, without which will make it easier for this or any future president to use the military to restore domestic order without the consent of the nation's governors. End of quote from Pat Leahy, the only senator to stand up and speak out about this. He said, we certainly do not need to make it easier for presidents to declare martial law. Well, we just did. We just did. At the same time that we set aside habeas corpus, even in the United States. Where is this country going? 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Oh, look out, they're coming to get you. They got the star, the American star, upside down. The sign of the devil. It's the GOP! No, I'm sorry, it's Halloween. Yeah. No, it's both. It's both. Harold Ford, by the way. This is great. Harold Ford in Tennessee coming out and saying, okay, that's it, you guys. He's going to quote from the Bible. He says, there's one big difference between us and Republicans when it comes to our faith. Republicans fear the Lord. Democrats fear and love the Lord. This is Harold Ford in Tennessee. He's saying, no, we're not going to take this about being beat up by Republicans for not having faith. So what is his, a Republican here, Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee, she says, this is incredibly disturbing. It's outrageous for Harold Ford to say, this is incredible. Republicans, how dare a Democrat talk about religion? You can't have that. Ellen Radner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, the website. Hey, Ellen.
Well, originally, Tom, Rahm Emanuel decided that he did not want to support anybody in sort of Howard Dean red states. But he's gotten a lot of pressure to do that, so he's just moved some money into Nebraska and Idaho, et cetera. But he is not supporting liberals in any way, shape, or form. And when we look over how the DNC, how the DCCC has done money at the end of this campaign, trust me, it will be moderate Democrats and not liberals that Rahm Emanuel is going for. There will also be neighboring states, to Illinois. He's put like $3 million into the Duckworth campaign or something, just an unbelievable amount of money. And then other races can't even get $5,000 from him.
Right, like Ellen Nelson.
It's just unbelievable. So what we're seeing is that he does not want the liberals. He wants no challenge to his leadership, and he wants to move up in the leadership.
So this is tragic, Ellen. Let me feed back to you what I think I just heard you say. That Rahm Emanuel, the guy who is in the DLC, who is one of these in the pocket of corporation Democrats, he's a conservative Democrat, a kind of Joe Lieberman light in the House of Representatives, is also the chairman of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee.
That's correct.
Only 35% of the candidates that the DCCC has fielded for these highly contested races, the 50 more or less highly contested races, only about 35% of them are in favor of withdrawing from Iraq, whether it be short term or over with a timetable. Most of them are, 70% of them almost are kind of stay the coursers. They're pro free trade in quotes. They're the DLC Democrats. And Rahm Emanuel is withholding funds from liberal Democrats who could actually win races because he doesn't want to have to deal with liberal Democrats in the House of Representatives.
The word has it that he only cares that they get the House back. He doesn't care about the amount of seats.
That's tragic.
I mean, if you asked him, he's never going to admit it, but I think if you and I sat down and did an analysis after the election's over as to where the money goes, it's not going to be to where Tom Hartman and Ellen Ratner would like money to go.
Yeah. So how do we get Rahm Emanuel out of power in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think what's going to have to happen is that if the Democrats take over the House and if we see this wave like we saw, you know, with 70 seats in 94, that the Progressive Caucus is and the Black Caucus is going to really have to make noise. Yeah. That's the only way.
Well, together they outnumber the DLC caucus, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. But we're going to have to keep pressure on to make sure that those people really do have a voice.
Well, and it's the DLC guys who have access to the big corporate bucks. So it's like the, you know, the dark side. I mean, it's they're right there.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Rahm Emanuel pops right in here to say hi.
You know what? And the other thing I would do, even though he won't, I would invite him on your show, Tom.
He won't come. Well, here's the problem, Ellen. You get these politicians on, and if you ask them tough questions, they freak out and never come back, and it's a mess. And if you're just, you know, friendly and gentle and you suck up to them, then you've lost your integrity. So by and large, I don't put politicians on the radio other than Bernie Sanders, because Bernie will answer any question and he'll tell you the absolute truth about what he thinks on something, you know, whether you like it or not.
Well, actually, you know who else is like that to some degree is Barney Frank.
Yeah, Barney Frank, and I ought to have him on once in a while. And actually, Ron Paul, the conservative, I've had him on a couple of times, and, you know, he'll give you a straight answer to a question. Yeah, you know, I disagree with him on most things, but at least he's an honest guy. But most of these guys, they're more interested in politics than they are anything else. So.
Right. Well, I really wanted to give you the Rahm Emanuel update, because although he is putting money into Nebraska and Idaho, and I believe also Montana, he's really avoiding a lot of, and those states are not having liberal Democrats run.
Where is it? Is there a central place where liberal Democrats who have a real opportunity, a real chance to win a race, where people can find like a list of them where they can? I know a friend of yours is running in Arizona.
Ellen Simon, that's
Ellen
right.
Ellen Simon, I'm sorry, I called her Nelson. And her website is Ellen Simon for Congress, is it?
EllenSimonForCongress.com. And, right. You know, her opponent, Rick Renzi, hasn't shown up for 7 debates. She's been debating the libertarian guy.
Incredible. Incredible.
And all these local right-wing papers in Arizona, supported him.
Yeah. But she has a chance to win.
She has an excellent chance to win.
And she needs money. EllenSimonForCongress.com and help her out. Okay. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com.
Thank you.
Ellen, thank you very much. Good talking with you. Amazing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, what's up?
Yes, blessed be and merry meet. Happy
indeed.
Stalin.
Blessed be here on Halloween.
Hey, you know, I was a history teacher, and I could clarify a little bit about Vlad Dracul. Dracul was actually the Order of the Dragon. That was his knighthood order. And his family name was Tepeș. And yes, he was brutal, he was psychotic, but no more so than every other monarch in Europe at that time. So let's put it in perspective. And in Romania, he is actually considered a hero because he conducted a holy war against Muslim Turks.
Plus, he brings in tourist dollars now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
he's like a major tourist attraction. Yeah, interesting. Okay, KJ.
And by the way, you talked about Republicans. You intimate that they worship the devil.
Well, that they are using the upside-down pentagram, the upside-down five-pointed star on their logo, which historically, according to the folks that I know who are very concerned about Satan worshippers, is one of the I realize it's also used for other things, but Go ahead.
Someone accused Karl Rove of worshipping Satan, and I don't think that's true. I think Satan worships him.
Well said. KJ, thanks a lot for the call. Claire in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Claire, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I was alarmed by something I heard recently. A friend at a party was telling me, as a Comcast worker, that he has been trained most recently in profiling. And so that when people go into your house to hook up your cable, they assess you on, I don't know the specifics, they assess you on a scale. And if you come up at a certain number, they call the government and turn you in. No, I mean...
This is a logical extension of John Poindexter's TIPS program, where he was... this was actually talked about out in public. Let's have the meter readers and you know, whatnot. I mean, whoever it may be, people who go into people's homes, look for signs that there may be terrorists in there. Do they have a poster on the wall of Osama bin Laden? Do they have a machine gun in the corner?
Are they new to the area? Are they asking about certain things?
Right.
And my concern with that is that as long as we had due process and habeas corpus, that may have been a logical thing to do, but without those, it becomes a very scary thing.
Yeah.
And
this is the way a police state is set up. Let me tell you, in Germany, in the mid-1930s, Hitler started this program, or actually it was Goebbels who started it, where you could phone into your local radio station and denounce your neighbors on the air. And, you know, this is somebody who's not loyal to the Nazi party. This is somebody who might be a communist. This is somebody who might be a Jew. This is somebody, you know, like that. And you could denounce people. And people were denounced on the air. And their neighbors, in many cases, would go show up at their houses and trash their houses. I mean, that's how hysterical it got.
Well, I know I couldn't sleep so well that night thinking that someone I know very well is defending this. Well, is a person that doesn't really trust the Bush administration but sees what he's doing as on the right side of this, but not understanding that where's the line, who's drawing the line, and what will they be asked to report on next? And I'm most concerned about someone who really doesn't have training. I mean, it has given a small amount of training and a great sense of importance and can be totally turning in someone totally innocent. And we've seen that happen. And when we won't be able to hear about it. You know,
right. The person they turn in may just disappear.
Right.
From the Bush administration, as people have.
I know, having just gone to a peace march, that it was in the paper that everybody that participated now has an FBI file. This is alarming.
Yeah. We are watching the construction brick by brick of a police state in the United States. The question is, will we be able to stop it before we tip into fascism?
Right.
Will we be able to restore traditional American ideals before the whole thing, pushes over at the hands of the Bush administration? And I sure hope so. Claire, thanks for the heads up on that. Hopefully some reporters out there are listening and can do some good follow-up on this. This is in Pittsburgh, right, Claire?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Grim news, but not surprising, given who's in power right at the moment. And all the more reason to get out there and vote. 45 minutes past the hour.
The devil bowed his head because he knew that he'd been beat. And he laid that golden fiddle on the ground at Johnny's feet. Johnny said, "Devil, just come on back if you ever want to try again. I done told you once, you son of a... I'm the best there's ever been." He played Bound the Mountain, Run, Boy, Run.
Yes, welcome back. It's Halloween. Those who are believers in earth religions and animism and in Wicca, you know, it's a good day. And for some rather nervous Christians, it's the devil's day. And I say to them, hey, look at the logo of the GOP. That's all you need to do. 1-866-440-8466, because you'll find these upside-down stars. John in Seattle. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
I was calling about the devil's logo. I Googled devil's hand sign, Bush,
mm-hmm.
and you'll get a whole list of pictures of Bush and his entire family flashing the devil's hand sign at you.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, the first one I got was Prison Planet, but, you know, you get a whole long list, and you just go down the list. They're all sitting there. They like to describe it as hook 'em horns, which is, I think...
But wait a minute. This is also the sign of the Texas Rangers, isn't it, or one of the Texas teams?
Well, that's confusing point. Hook 'em horns is different, very different from the sign of the devil, and... You do a little research and you'll find it.
What is one with the hand forward and the other with the hand backwards or something like that? We're talking basically about the,
one
about
is,
the index finger and the little finger being extended, right?
Right. And the devil sign is your two outside fingers. The hook 'em horns is your thumb and the little finger extended and everything else held down. That's Hook'em Horns. It's their football sign for the Longhorn.
So all the Bush pictures that you see are not the football sign. They are the devil sign.
No, not at all. They're
interesting.
They usually have the two center fingers down and the thumb over them, and the two outside fingers extended up.
Right.
And the pictures I'm looking at, they have the fingers pointing outwards, the palm and hand pointing outwards. Yep.
Okay, so there you go. There you go. It's the Satan worshippers have taken over America. It's the thank you, John. The Bush family and of course the GOP. As I said, just look at their logo. Speaking of evil and violence, Senator George Allen. This breaking news. A fellow asked George Allen at one of his events. George Allen, the senator from Virginia, who's running for re-election. This guy comes up and asks him about why did he spit on his first wife. This is an allegation that his first wife made. And, fairly straightforward question, you would say. And there's videotape of it now on the web of one of Allen's guys coming over and smashing this guy up against a window and slamming him down on the floor for just asking a question. George Allen, Mr. Jock, Mr. Violence, Mr. Macaca. Here it is. Senator George Allen made a campaign stop in Charlottesville Tuesday morning and was met with controversy. As Senator Allen was exiting the ballroom, coming to talk to the media, a protester started yelling and asking, "Why did you spit on your first wife?" He wasn't able to get near the senator as he was tackled by three men wearing Allen stickers. He was pushed and manhandled and ended up on the floor. Senator Allen went back into a conference room, and after the man was removed from the building, they asked him what he thought of it. He said, "Stuff like that happens." Yeah. Yeah, you just, somebody who asks you a question, you beat him up and throw him to the floor. Yeah. We're seeing this sort of thing happen all over the world, aren't we, Jeff, in Tacoma? Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Not much time, so I just want to get this out. An American journalist was just assassinated by an off-duty police officer in Mexico during the general strike down there.
Right,
and 14 people have been killed. So
yes, and what we're seeing down there is the real version of what just happened with George Allen, which is the basically the government is this is in fact I saw yesterday a news story describing this. Is it pronounced Oaxaca?
Oaxaca.
Oaxaca, thank you. You're right. Oaxaca.
And the governor of there is like, he's like George Bush on steroids.
I know. And he's ruled. He can't even go into, the state governor's mansion or whatever. He's holed up in a five-star hotel.
The thing I really want to talk about is that the media, including liberal talk show hosts, are saying that the violence is due to the unrest, as if the protesters are waging war on each other.
No,
and that's wrong.
It's not. The violence, this started out as a teacher's strike.
They're using the assassinations to justify their siege of the city.
Right. And then other workers joined the teachers, and then it became a general union movement standing up against the government. And it kind of mixed into the, "Hey, we think the election got stolen" movement. And this is Vicente Fox basically handing off to Calderon a gift. Here, we will wipe out the left-wing opposition down in, pronounce it again, Jeff.
Oaxaca.
Thank you.
I'd like to tell everybody in America who's like a trade unionist or cares about workers, please go to www.iww.org. That's the Wobbly website, and it'll tell you everything you can do to protest this.
IWW.org, the International Workers of the World.
Yeah, and this is a dry run for what they want to do here, in my opinion.
I do not disagree with you, Jeff. This is certainly what Bush has set up the legal basis for doing over the last 6 months. And, and it's just, characteristic of like what we're seeing right now in the George Allen campaign of the strong arming. I mean, we're back to Kent State only on steroids as well.
Yeah, and if we let him do that, Hitler's right around the corner.
Yeah, well, certainly the loss of American democracy. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. IWW.org for more information. Boy, oh boy. It is so important. It is so important. We have just a few days left to get out there, get active, get involved. Another $10, $20, whatever you've got, send it to a progressive candidate who is in a race that can be won, and let's take this country back. Remember, always remember, democracy only works if we're all involved in it. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.